Hello, everybody, and welcome to another FIA Group webinar. My name is Adam Russo. I'm the co-founder and CEO of the FIA Group. With me, as always, is Ron. Say hello, Ron.
Hello, Ron.
You know, Ron, people love to hear that. They love so many times I'm on the road, and as you all know, I've been on the road for like 2 months straight, and people say to me, hello, Ron. Hello, Ron. I'm like, they do. They say it to me, Ron. It's like our trademark. We should, we should trademark that phrase,
I think. I'm going to start putting out T-shirts, hats. You let me know.
In addition, Brady is with us again. Obviously, some fun stuff is happening in D.C. Say hello, Brady.
Hello, Brady.
And last but not least, the most popular, the one that everyone loves, the reason why hundreds and thousands of you dial in and listen to us, we have Jen McCormick here with us today. Jen?
Hello.
So, folks, what are we going to talk about today? We're going to talk about best practices for today's plan documents, and we're also going to obviously talk about what's happening in D.C., these changes that President Trump, I still have a hard time saying those two words together, President Trump, some of the ideas and things that he's doing or undoing when it comes to Obamacare and the ACA, how that will affect you and our self-funded plans and our administrators. Folks, so what we're talking about today relates to our flagship plan document template. Many of our clients are raving about it. It's really easy to use because we have basically made many of those best practice choices. Jen McCormick would love to have called this the best practices template, but Ron Peck just overruled her. We called it the flagship. It's much easier to use, much quicker to put together, and for those of you that have fully insured plans that are going to self-funding for the first time, it might make sense for you to use the flagship because you can complete a checklist in a quarter of the time that it takes you right now. In addition, we're also adding a schedule of benefits as well as SBC automation to the flagship and normal PPO network templates, and we'll hopefully have that done by the end of this year. So, guys, guess what? It's great to be back. I know that none of you are happy that I'm back. I know that. I can see it from the faces of people here. Maybe the first day, they're like, oh, Adam's back. Maybe he'll be a nice guy. I can already tell today that in the first 4 hours of here that people just waited for me to go back on the road. So I apologize, but I'm here till Christmas. So it's cooler temperatures outside. We're expecting the weather to turn to be a little bit nicer. But again, thank you to all of you who have dialed in. We got a lot to talk about. So first, make sure you follow us on LinkedIn. Go to LinkedIn, search for the FIA Group. Decide to follow Ron or myself. Pretty much that's the only people you need to follow at FIA. Right, Ron?
That'll cover it.
That's going to cover it. I mean, we got everything else covered. But feel free to follow us on our LinkedIn page where you'll find out about a bunch of stuff. Matt is also doing some more stuff as it relates to our social media, where we are going to start asking questions. We're bringing up ideas and topics for you guys to comment on that we can then tie into our webinars and podcasts. Speaking of podcasts, we will be doing a podcast on Thursday with the expectation that will be posted on our YouTube page on Apple Podcasts by Friday. And we're expecting that to be tied primarily to what's going on in D.C., at which point in time we will have Brady as our guest, special guest, to talk about all the Trump happenings down there. And we're excited about that opportunity as well. All right. So what's going on in D.C.? We're going to see it here. We will also discuss some more plan drafting tips as well as talk to Jen McCormick next week in regards to another podcast tied directly to our flagship template and some of the do's and don'ts when it comes to plan design. Really quickly, and I apologize for going off topic for a second. Just this morning, Brady and I have been dealing with many, I would say there's three different stop-loss policies and different papers that we've looked at that's issued across the country and some of the provisions that we're noticing in the stop-loss policies that we, to be quite frank, we just haven't seen before. Small provisions within supplements, just stuff that is a little scary as it relates to the self-funded industry. If you are working with a carrier or if you happen to have to work with a carrier because you know, you've acquired a TPA, you've been brought in as the broker of record, whatever the situation may be. If you are using any stop-loss paper that you're not used to using, please reach out to us because we're noticing a trend, and it's not a good trend. And if we can do anything to help the self-insured marketplace, one of the areas to start is the stop-loss world. So I know I'm a little off topic there because we're talking about plan docs today, but it's something that's been bugging me all morning, and I just wanted to get off my chest and make sure I shared it with the thousands of you that are listening. If you have a stop-loss carrier that you're not used to working with or an MGU, please reach out to us to take a look at that policy for you before it's too late. Okay, As always, Ron and I, Chapter 13, was the chapter that Ron and I were happy to write with on behalf of Dave Chase. His book has been sent out to hundreds of our clients. Thousands of you have even downloaded the book from our site. We're excited about it. We're noticing there's a more and more interest in real transparency, getting employees to realize they are consumers and not just patients. So we're excited about it. People, it was great. Yesterday I was speaking at the Captivated Health Conference just north of Boston with my good friends at Boris Law Insurance, and there was a speaker before me, and I'll be straightforward. Typically when I speak, I'm always like, yeah, great. I get to go after this guy or this girl. I know they're going to bore the audience to death, and I'm going to go up there and just start shaking things up. The guy before me was a doctor by the name of Jeff Gold. Jeff,
yeah.
I know he was very nervous, but I was really impressed with his speech. And, you know, he talked about addictions. And obviously the big addiction that everyone talks about today is the opioid crisis. And he brought up the fact that there's another addiction that people have that we don't talk about and is also destroying our healthcare system. And it's the addiction to insurance. Now, unlike any other industry, people just assume that insurance is going to cover it. And that's part of the problem that we have in our industry. I thought it was very interesting. So, as always, myself and Ron are here. Jen is our special guest alongside with Brady. So we're excited about it. What are we going to talk about? We're going to talk about the political update with Brady. We're going to do some housekeeping measures. We're going to have Jen talk about the FAQ. What are the frequently asked questions in the month of September? And also the early parts of October. And last but not least, the reason you're here, what are the best practices when it comes to plan documents? These are specific, detailed things. We're going to do another one again next month, have two more podcasts as relate to this, because we feel over the next few months, so many of you are so busy right now in renewal season, getting your plans to adopt the right plan language is going to make the biggest difference. So, speaking of that agenda, what are the best practices that we want to focus on? Definitions. Exclusions. Again, if you purchase the flagship, we choose these for you. So many of you have 200 employee benefit plans with 20 different definitions for the same exact exclusion. You need to change it. It's only a potential E&O claim. Next, the services and payable amounts, how you define it within the plan. Defining the word discretion, and I'm going to be straightforward on this one. Ron and I got some real pushback. Mm-hmm. From our flagship before we launched it, when we spoke to certain carriers and administrators and brokers in regards to our discretionary language provision, many people thought it was too broad. And you know what? Ron and I looked at each other and said, you know what? They're right. And I said, Ron, we got to fix this. So we made a couple changes, went back to everyone, and everyone agreed. Our discretionary language now is much, much tighter, much better. It protects the industry much better. And it helps protect stop-loss carriers, the plans, and the administrators, and I think overall it's just a better worded provision thanks to the honest feedback we received from our clients and our partners. In addition, we're going to talk about eligibility and enrollment, and last but not least, our favorite topic to discuss, subrogation. What is the best language you need to have? We're noticing more and more across the country, attorneys are getting a little bit more aggressive. They're more willing to just blow off a lien. So if you're not working with FIA as when it comes to your subrogation rights, now is probably the time to do so. In addition, again, a little off topic, but ties to subrogation. Please note, on the next issue is the questionnaire changes. One of the big things that we now realize is that many of our clients have groups that do not want accident questionnaires, accident letters to be sent to their members. Great. We don't want to send letters either. Sending letters is a thing of the 80s. It's what I did when I was in Boy Scouts. Okay, I sent letters home to my mom. Now they use something called Facebook or Instagram or Twitter or something. Well, they don't use LinkedIn for that, I guess, but we would. But the point is, if you have groups that you feel would rather have emails sent to the HR department inquiring about things, if you have clients that just don't want to use questionnaires at all, and instead want us to use all the database access and the scrubbing techniques that we can, where we can identify subrogation opportunities without a questionnaire, please feel free to contact any of us or Garrick here at FIA, and we can make that change right off the bat for you. In addition, reference-based pricing. There's a lot more litigation out there going on, balance billing, out-of-pocket maximum. There is potentially going to be some DOL guidance that could have an adverse effect on our reference-based pricing models, our approaches, our language, how we handle balanced billing, what we can and cannot do. All these are things that are coming out. And last but not least, before I turn it over to Brady, our very own Catherine Dowie, who has been working at SPIA for many, many years, she's been here since college. She now attends law school at night at Suffolk. And for those of you who don't know, who've never done it, going to law school at night is not easy. It's full-time nights, and you work a full-time job during the day. She came in second place in a national brief competition against thousands of qualified people, most of which do not have jobs. Kids that go to law school, that's their job. She was doing all this and came in second place and won a $25,000 cash award for the great work she did. We are excited that Catherine is going to be here as an attorney representing our subrogation interests as well as the self-funded community's interests as a whole. She's a great addition to our industry and someone that we're really proud of, so I just wanted to give a quick shout-out to Catherine Dowie, and feel free to contact her as well to congratulate her. And with that, I'm going to turn over to Brady Bizarro to talk about the political whirlwind that we're seeing in Washington. Brady?
Thanks, Adam. Well, I think a whirlwind is the best way to describe it because really in the last few weeks a lot has happened, and a lot of it does directly impact our industry. I think buried in this news is we can't forget that a big deal happened, you know, at the end of September when the Secretary of HHS resigned. Remember the travel scandal he had with private travel? He's gone. So in the interim, President Trump has filled the spot with a man named Eric Hargan, who is a Deputy Secretary. But we're not sure what his priorities are or how long he'll be in that role, but we're going to be watching that because that's a pretty important role for our purposes. Where he takes the agency in terms of enforcement and rules and regulations, we just don't know. We knew a lot more about Price, but we'll be watching this guy. So that happened. Then this Graham Cassidy bill that, if you recall from the last webinar, I made a bold prediction about how it would not actually pass. And I want to point out that I was right here. So I want to get that on the record that I was right for once. I hear some applause in the background, but
you said it was 60-40 that it would pass too. So just to make sure, you said 60-40.
Put my feet to the fire and said, "What's your call?" I said, "No," and that's.
So why would you say 60? But you still said 60% that it would.
Well, I mean, we'll get the tape on that.
Brady,
one.
Yeah.
To make sure.
Brady, are the Patriots going to cover the spread at any point? Because I need some help.
I'll get back to me on that one. But remember that Graham Cassidy was really the last chance Republicans had to change the ACA legislatively. It was really taking all the federal funds in Obamacare, including the Medicaid expansion funds, and issuing them as a block grant to the states. That should be appealing to Republicans. It wasn't. It died. It's a big deal. What happens now? Well, remember that this was being done through budget reconciliation, and now, because next year is going to need a new budget, it's possible that Republicans could provide in that budget new reconciliation rules that would allow them to pass a repeal and replace bill with 50 votes again. So, in other words, this is not going to go away. As long as Republicans stay in the majority in Congress, which they will for at least the end of next year, the prospect or the specter of repeal and replace won't go away. But then we had a couple bombshells that President Trump gave to us. First, you might recall that he sort of issued a threat to his fellow Republicans that he may work with Democrats to get a bill done. And he sort of hoped that would move some of the GOP moderates. When that didn't work, he decided that he would take matters into his own hands. And so I got one of his tweets that sort of was a premonition for what he's trying to do now to Obamacare. And I like this graphic because I think it was the only thing I could find when I just Googled, you know, Trump crushing something. But I don't know what that's from, but that's the ACA. And what we have going on.
Is that a wine opener?
It could be a wine opener. I don't know. I think it's great. But the ACA is under the weight of all of whatever the heck that is. And he's doing it with the power of the pen. Another tweet from him there. We had really a series of three bombshells that came out, starting with on October 6th, the administration narrowed the contraceptive mandate. And I want to just point out, like Adam said, that we're going to go into much more detail on what happened with these executive orders and these regulations on our podcast because we don't have all the time in the world, unfortunately, today. But I will give you –
make sure they dial in, right, Brady?
Right, dial in. I won't give all the information away today, and you know, I don't want to spoil anything, but I will tell you it's important to give a rundown about how this directly impacts our industry and, frankly, how it impacts employer-sponsored insurance in general. So basically what happened here is the agencies have issued rules which expand the current exemptions for employers who do not want to provide contraceptive coverage. Previously, that was reserved for closely held for-profit corporations like the Hobby Lobby Group in that case that came out a few years ago, or religious nonprofits or religious employers like churches. They were allowed to opt out of the concept of coverage requirement. Now, people who have or employers who have a moral objection will also be able to opt out of this ACA requirement. Now, predictably, we don't know what that exactly means. What is a moral requirement? That's the big key here. But it's going to, in short, broaden substantially the number of employers who qualify for an exemption to the birth control coverage mandate of the ACA. So we'll be following that closely. That's how it impacts employers in a nutshell. How does it impact TPAs? Well, because if you recall, the existing rules as they were written, when you opted out of providing birth control coverage as an employer, you had to either self-certify to your insurance carrier if you were fully insured, or to HHS itself if you were self-funded, that you were opting out of the requirement. And then it fell on the TPA to step in and otherwise provide coverage. One additional change in this rule is that accommodation process has now been made optional. So you may have employers that want to utilize the moral or religious exemption, and they don't even have to say they're doing that, which means that for those employers who don't self-certify, their TPAs will not be required to otherwise provide coverage. So that's a potentially big deal. And we do have a question out to HHS right now because, as you may recall from previous rules, they don't often specify self-funded or fully funded on the first go-around of these rules. And they didn't this time either. But that's the way we interpret it. That's the way many people in our industry have interpreted this rule. So there's a lot of distinctions there, and we'll go into more depth on the podcast. But that was one of the first bombshells. Then came this executive order, which you signed last Thursday on the 12th, which really affected three big issue areas, one of which is this association health plans issue. And really, we've seen association health plans before. We know them as MEWAs, right? They are state-regulated multiple employer welfare arrangements. An AHP is really just a MEWA that's tied into an association or something like a chamber of commerce. The bottom line with that change is that the administration is looking, and this is an idea that came from Senator Rand Paul, to allow small employers and individuals to basically join MEWAs, to loosen the restrictions on MEWAs or AHPs. You can refer to them basically interchangeably. But basically, if you allow more small employers that maybe aren't related by association or you don't have some number of employers that are required to join, if they can nonetheless band together and form a MEWA that can cross state lines, protected by ERISA in many ways, then the concern on the other side is, well, state insurance commissioners suddenly have a lot less power in regulating these small employer plans. And so for small employers, this would be an attractive thing. And SIA recently came out with a newsletter on this, and they're following this issue because, remember, the executive order is not rules. It's just an order directing agencies to begin the process of creating rules. And so we're going to be following what they come up with because for the self-funded industry, having a MEWA that could potentially cover multiple states or one that, you know, the restrictions are more loosely interpreted, that's a good thing potentially for our industry. So we'll be watching and see what exactly they come up with the final rules. So short-term insurance. Briefly, how the law existed currently was that you could offer short-term health plans, but they couldn't be offered for longer than 3 months, and you didn't have to cover many parts of the ACA on those plans. The administration has now loosened the rules on those short-term plans. You can now offer them for up to as long as 12 months, and they can be renewable. That's potentially a big deal. And finally, on HRAs. So the executive order directs the agencies to expand the flexibility of HRAs, and they focused on three rules, making employer HRA contributions tax-deductible, allowing HRA funds to be used for premium reimbursement, that's a big deal, and allowing HRAs to be used in conjunction with non-group coverage. So big deals on this executive orders, and some of them impact our industry, and we'll go into depth more about association health plans and, you know, the interpretation of the rules according to HHS on the podcast. But I do want to talk briefly about these cost-sharing reductions because that other shoe dropped on Friday morning and was a big deal. Actually, I was attending a conference in Boston where this issue was raised because it really threw a live grenade in many ways into the individual insurance market, into the marketplaces. And so basically, I want to explain briefly what CSRs are. They are cost-sharing reduction payments. The government was issuing insurance companies basically a subsidy in exchange for them offering discounts on cost-sharing to low-income people on the marketplace. So the ACA required them, the insurance companies, to offer a discount on out-of-pocket expenses. In exchange, the government would step in and pay subsidies to these insurance carriers. This is different than the premium tax credits. That's a separate issue for people who qualify for those. With the end of the CSRs now, essentially what you have is insurance companies being required by law to offer discounts, but the government not paying them back. What's going to happen? Premiums are going to go up. So in the individual market, premiums will go up, and therefore premium subsidies will go up. So this really impacts most the people who are on the individual exchanges who don't qualify for subsidies. They're going to see their premiums go up, and this is really going to destabilize the market, frankly. And it doesn't apply directly to employer insurance, but it's probably going to bleed over in some ways, and it was a big deal. So I wanted to just summarize.
In what ways is it bleeding over?
I mean, so
could you make an argument that this is a benefit to self-funded employers, since now people who may have not opted to purchase insurance through a self-funded employer now will?
You could, but for all the carriers who are losing all this money, they may try to make up the cost in other ways by raising prices in other areas.
Right.
That's a risk.
But in the self-funded space, how can they raise the cost? The self-funded plans are paying the claims. So this isn't a fully insured plan. The self-funded business is self-funded. So the fully insured carriers may have to increase premiums to employers that are fully insured. Therefore, those employers now go, maybe I should self-fund because my premiums keep going up. So I look at this as a potential positive for self-funding. You don't have to agree with me.
Right.
I know you don't agree with me.
Yeah.
But I just think it's something that it's worth discussing.
And it could be, yeah. So those are the big things, the big changes last week. I would say in sum, what's going on here is the president is taking it into his own hands to really piece by piece, you know, deconstruct parts of the ACA. In general, when that happens, as we talked about with any ACA repeal and replace bill, employer insurance is largely insulated, but this deal about association health plans, this deal with the contraceptive mandate, these things directly impact our industry, and we'll be letting you know, as more rules come out and as more guidance is issued on these issue areas. And with that, I will turn it over to Jen for our PGC FAQ.
All right. Thank you. Okay. So just to tack on a bit to what Brady was just talking about, one of the questions, which I'm sure is not a surprise, that we have been receiving over the past couple of weeks is, with these new rules about contraceptive coverage, how is this going to have an impact on my self-funded plan? And the focus of today is talking about our best practices when it comes to plan drafting. And I'm not going to give everything away, Brady, I promise. I'll let you have something else to talk about the podcast. But there are a couple of things that I think are important to discuss when it comes to the impact to our plan documents, when it comes to what it is that we need to be on the lookout for and how the documents should be drafted. So let's start with the things that didn't change. So the new rules will not impact the extent of coverage that's still required to be covered. So there's still the 18 FDA-approved contraceptives that are still required to be covered for some plans. So the scope of contraceptives have not changed. Also, what hasn't changed is the fact that there is still an accommodation process. There is still a process that is going to be in effect. The extent of that accommodation process has actually changed. So one of the things that is key here for our plan drafting purposes is there was an exemption, which means there was no notice required. There was no opportunity to seek or otherwise provide coverage for certain entities, and there was an accommodation process. Now it has expanded so that the exemption, where there's no requirement to offer coverage, has greatly expanded. So the scope of individuals that are now eligible for an exemption in addition to an accommodation is quite large. So when we have this opportunity not only to not have to offer it, but not have to worry about someone else to pay for it, maybe that could include a different burden or a different requirement on how an administrator who previously, through the accommodation process, would have had to outline or otherwise provide for coverage through offsetting by going to the exchange. Now, if that process is just optional, that might open the door for some other plans that maybe have a moral objection, whatever that might mean, to not have to cover these benefits to decide to eliminate that from their plan. But if they are looking to eliminate their plan, how are they going to do it? What are the rules? What is it that they must do? So what we do know from the new rules is that if you are looking to make a change to your plan, the rescission rules are still in place. So this is not something where you can immediately rescind the coverage for contraceptives onto the plan. There still needs to be notice that is provided to these plan participants somehow, whether it's an amendment or an SMR, that notifies them that as of X date, based on my moral objection or my religious belief, that this is no longer going to be covered under our plan. We have to make sure that if this is a change, that potentially impacts our SBC, for example, that we are providing these 60 days advance notice. And as we all know, renewal time is right around the corner, and there's different rules for renewals. So when we're talking about what it is we're going to do with these potential modifications to our plans, keep in mind that if this was a benefit that previously was covered in our plan, you can't just immediately decide to remove this benefit without providing any notice. So what you need to do when it comes to these updates and making these modifications to our plan is to look at the coverage that is currently offered and make sure that people understand how this is going to impact them as an employer, but also potentially impact their TPA as to whether or not they're going to be qualifying for an exemption or qualifying for an optional accommodation, which would have potential other obligations on their administrator. The next question is in regards to dependents and whether or not we can vary the contribution levels based on a dependent child's marital status. So in light of the ACA, we know that we have to cover dependent children through age 26. And one of the requirements under ACA is that we could not condition coverage based on any factors, whether it was their marital status, whether it was their student status, or whether it was them residing with their parents still. At this point, we can't contribute different amounts for a dependent child if they're under 26. But what we can do when it comes to dependents is that we are able to have a potential spousal surcharge. It's not a dependent spouse who must be covered or a employee spouse that must be covered under the plan. So if you're looking to vary contributions or add potentially a surcharge, the way to do it is not through a dependent child, but potentially through your spouse. Last but not least, as I'm thinking about making a change to my benefit plan, what considerations should I take into account? Well, if you're making a benefit change to your plan, you need to consider whether this is going to reduce your potential coverage and thus you're going to be required to have an SMR. You're going to have to review any potential contracts that you have with an administrator or your stop-loss carrier to make sure that when you're making this change to your benefit plan that you are providing proper notification. This is possible that based on your stop-loss policy or your administrative services agreement, it could be required that that actual change is first approved prior to being implemented.
This is a recent thing that we've noticed more and more carriers now denying claims based on this provision, that they're not being notified of a plan amendment change. It's not only about notification as to when they have to be notified. Typically, we've seen 30 days, but we just saw one that said 31 days. I've seen one that said 90 days, which I don't know how that's even possible. So, again, these little provisions you got to be careful of, and when you, as you make a change, what you need to take into account. Jen?
Yeah, and not only the notification of a carrier or your administrator, make sure that you're notifying the participants as well, because this is a change to their benefit plan, so they obviously need to be aware of the changes that are being made and how it will impact their benefits. And with that, I think I'm going to be turning it back over to Brady.
Actually, this is not. It's you.
Come on, Jen. Just when we thought Jen was on a roll, we have to kick her off the monthly webinars again, Ron.
You're tired, Jen. You're done.
Well, Brady was talking for 45 minutes.
That's
so
true.
Jeez, I'm exhausted listening.
That's true. I don't see any fun pictures here, Jen.
All right, so let's get into these definitions. What are the best practices? What do we want to tell people about each one of these definitions? Again, as always, we have them defined in our best practices mode in our flagship template. Feel free to reach out. But, Jen?
All right, so the first one, I'm sure that it's not a surprise that we've been talking about leave of absence and continuing coverage under our plan. So in light of all of these changes, the potential issues that we're seeing with stop loss reimbursement coverage, what a plan is supposed to do, and what an employer is supposed to do when it comes to this, it's really important that you have a tight actively at work definition that clearly outlines when an individual is actively at work versus when they're not actively at work, because that could have a big implication about whether or not they're eligible for coverage or reimbursement through a stop loss policy. So it's important to review your provision, make sure that it outlines things like you're still actually at work if you're on PTO or if you're on vacation time. So review that provision. Obviously, we have updated our provision to account for some of the issues that we are seeing as far as gaps in coverage. The next big term is the max allowable charge definition. So for years, we've been talking about there's a difference between UNC when it comes to the amount versus a claim that is reasonable when it relates to the basis of the charge. Now, based on all of the experience, we have actually combined all of these amazing parameters into one single definition. So instead of having to revert to multiple different sections in the document, we're offering the opportunity to have one extremely comprehensive definition that outlines not only the parameters that an employer and plan should be taking into consideration when they're outlining how claims should be paid, whether there is or is not a network that's in place, we've captured all of that. So regardless of whether you have a plan that uses one network, has multiple tiers of network, whether you have a plan that uses no network, you can use this same definition for all of those plans, and it captures all of those parameters to give you the maximum amount of ability to contain the cost by having all the information right there in front of you. The next definition that we want to draw your attention to is provider. So Adam was talking a little bit earlier about how everyone is talking about the opioid crisis, right? So there's a lot of opportunity for people to be seeking treatment for these drug-related expenses and going to rehab or a residential treatment facility. So a lot of these facilities, not all, but some of them may not necessarily have the proper accreditation. Or maybe there's an issue where you're trying to send someone to a international facility to receive treatment outside of the opioid issue, but maybe for a surgery, a knee surgery, and it's a foreign provider. And maybe your current definition of provider outlines the parameters that would be relevant for a current domestic provider, but not necessarily a foreign provider. Or maybe you want to have tighter parameters for the types of providers that you want to consider to be eligible for coverage and reimbursement onto your plan. So we have taken a look at our definition of provider to try and tighten it up to make sure that we can account for those types of situations. Next is the essential health benefit definition. It's not a surprise that a plan needs to pick a benchmark, and the benchmark for defining what they consider to be an essential health benefit. So a lot of plans are maybe making the decision as far as the benchmark that they are outlining for their essential health benefits, but it's not documented anywhere. So now we're allowing the opportunity to have that actually outlined in the plan document. You can pick which benchmark you are specifically using in order to define your essential health benefits. So that way there can never be any confusion or clarification problems if you are defining chiro services to have a annual limit, thus not being considered essential based on the benchmark, maybe Utah, that you have selected. The next option to talk about for definitions is dependent. So there's been a lot of changes over the past years about who is considered to be a spouse and the extent that they are required to be offered coverage. So it's now the time, a couple of years have passed, and you should be reviewing the definitions of dependents to make sure that you are eliminating any outdated language that may list certain opposite sex only type of spouses to be the only ones that are excluded from coverage. Also, a domestic partner or a civil union is not a spouse. So if you are trying to cover a domestic partner or a civil union partner as a civil union or domestic partner, you need to make sure you actually say that. You cannot assume that a stop-loss carrier or anyone would understand that those different types of parties are actually considered spouses. They're different. And that could have implications, obviously, for stop-loss and reimbursement as well. The next is about genetic testing and pre-certification authorization. So there have been some issues lately when we're talking about the ACA preventive care requirements and what is required to be covered at 100% when it comes to genetic testing. There are certain types of testing procedures, particularly when it relates to prenatal testing, that are required to be covered without any sort of parameters or qualifications on them. So make sure that you're reviewing your definition of preventive care and all the services that are being covered to ensure that you're not unfairly requiring pre-authorization or certification for certain types of procedures. And last but not least, we did update our medically necessary definition. Adam and Ron talked about this a little bit too. We did review our discretion language to make sure that we were tightening it up for the benefit of all, to make sure that this is an opportunity for everyone to have language that affords the appropriate amount of discretion, but still is appropriate and it's not allowing you the opportunity to go crazy.
We've taken out a lot of the guesswork, so basically there's a framework involved so you can actually figure out what is the right amount of discretion, what is the reasonable amount of discretion there. So it's a much nicer language that flows much better.
And one of the concerns that we were also seeing when it comes to medical necessity is that there was confusion when we were outlining these different parameters, one of these being medical maintenance treatment. And the concern was, are we offering something? Is it medically necessary if we are trying to maintain somebody's current condition? So if they have a broken leg, we're trying to, or they have an illness, we're trying to maintain that. Is that medically necessary versus if we're trying to restore them to back to where they were previously? So we have tightened up that language, too, to make sure there's no gaps in understanding when it comes to what is considered medically necessary under the plan. And now, can you rate it
there
again?
Go. Good timing. So, yeah, I just want to add on to what Jen said, and most of the things that we're discussing in these couple slides are things that we don't typically address, and we wanted to make a concerted effort this time to do that. We typically talk about the same kind of definitions, the same kind of exclusions. So here we're looking at different exclusions and our best practice for those, and one of them is an alcohol exclusion, a separate exclusion that is really meant to supplement the plan's existing illegal acts exclusion. So this kind of language, you know, we recommend you have something separate that says something like you exclude charges that arise from someone taking part in activities made illegal due to the use of alcohol or a state of intoxication. That would be an example of what we're talking about here. This would be, you know, public drunkenness, or you have someone who's just underage drinking. That the act of that by itself is illegal. So this sort of adds on to your existing illegal act exclusion, where you may have some issues with the language you have in that provision or the causation problem. And if you have this separate alcohol exclusion, there's usually no doubt, you know, what you're relying on to address these kinds of
problems. My favorite fact patterns always relate to injuries resulting from the illegal use of alcohol.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if someone's illegally using alcohol, but then they, you know, have something fall from the sky and hit them in the head, you know, they still would have been hit in the head even if they weren't illegally using alcohol.
Well, I don't know, Adam. When I'm sober, my reflexes, I'm like a cat, you know.
Right.
Well, I've had a few drinks, you know.
But these are always, and again, we hate to admit it, but these are the cases where a bunch of us just get in a circle and go, whoa, look at this fact pattern. I mean, there's some pretty outrageous cases out there. But the fact patterns matter when it comes to this language, so it's important that it's not vague, that you actually understand the purpose behind a particular exclusion.
Right. We see these kinds of fact patterns on a regular basis. And one other note on this issue is we've seen plans that impose in these exclusions sort of limitations that we would hope that they don't use in the future, one of which is, you know, based on an arresting officer's, you know, assumption, but that's placing a limitation on the plan. You're assuming that there's going to be an officer there at the time, right, of the alcohol consumption. So, you know, don't place unnecessary verbiage in your exclusions that really limits the plan's rights. That goes for any exclusion. That's on alcohol. The next one here to talk about is provider error. So this one is, you know, we've seen these inversions called like never events or unreasonable error. The key here is that the plan wants to be generally excluding unreasonable provider errors, right? If for reasonable errors, you know, most plans are going to cover reasonable ones. You know, it's medical procedures, you expect certain things to go wrong. But for unreasonable errors, right, you want an exclusion for that. And you want to make sure that way when you have an issue arise, there's no debate as to what kind of error this was. You know exactly what kind of error the plan covers or not.
This is still going to be an issue, regardless of how good your language is. I wish it would just make the issue go away.
Yeah.
The problem is every clinical review organization out there is not equal. We have seen some of our clients use certain organizations out there, certain vendors, who write a 3-page report and have never looked at the plan doc. Others have a 30-page report written by a great, great doctor who's acclaimed, who's written books, and they have backup information. They reference the actual SPD in place.
Right.
Not all IROs are equal. Not all these companies are equal. So what one defines as unreasonable, another one might define as reasonable. So it's really important not to screw this up.
Right. And the key is make sure you just have some kind of adjective before the word error, because if you're just excluding errors, you're leaving it up to your carrier or other people to interpret what you mean by errors and try to be as clear as you can. And yes, there'll still be problems, but the more language there, the better. Another one we don't often talk about but is important is the vehicle accident exclusion. This is referring to things like seatbelts and helmets. We see these increasingly in plans, and this brings up the causation issue about, you know, what kind of claims are related to your failure to wear a helmet or your failure to wear a seatbelt. We've even had questions about, should I define the word helmet in the plan? Does the helmet have to have a visor? And these are all considerations and questions you want to be thinking about if you're a plan that says, you know what, if someone's not wearing their seatbelt and they incur catastrophic claims that they otherwise wouldn't have incurred, you know, there's language you can use for that. There's an exclusion you can use, and we can help you craft it in such a way that you can cover the claims you want and protect yourself. The last one here is occupational. We do talk about workers' comp exclusions in other areas, but the key I wanted to make here, the point is that really you want to go beyond the workers' comp exclusion. You want to make sure that you're including things like self-employment. Don't limit yourself in your workers' comp exclusion to, you know, if the claims could have been covered by an existing policy or if the claimant was eligible under an existing policy. If you keep it broad in this area, you'll find that it's covering more claims and you'll be able to cover all your bases.
Ron?
Nice. All right. Hello, Ron. Okay, here I am. All right, guys, let's finish strong. So speaking of exclusions, this is bad news when you aren't going to pay for something. People frequently ask, hey, you know, they lied. They didn't provide the right information. Isn't that fraud? This is sometimes an exclusion, meaning we don't have to pay for a claim if the claim itself is the result of misinformation. But more often you see fraud brought up as an actual reason to kick somebody from the plan. Fraud is interesting because it's not only going to address a claim as it actually comes in the door, but often when you determine that fraud occurred, you can actually go back and treat that payment that's already been made as an overpayment and get the money back. Fraud is one of the strongest reasons to recoup an overpayment. You'll find that the ability to recover an overpayment that's the result of some sort of procedural mistake, administrative mistake, your rights are very limited. But if you made a payment due to fraud, that being intentional misrepresentation, and you discover the fraud, your ability to get that money back is very strong. So when we talk about fraud, again, remember what I said, intentional misrepresentation. Just because somebody forgot to dot an I or cross a T or provided you with the wrong information, is that what caused a mistake? Yeah, sure, but it doesn't necessarily rise to the level of fraud. So if you want to exclude claims due to some sort of a clerical error or mistake, you're going to need to address it with words other than fraud, okay? Moving on, this is probably one of my favorites in the world of exclusion is excess, meaning that we don't pay claims in excess of the maximum allowable. Now, I know you're probably sitting there and you're scratching your head and you're saying, hey, Ron, that seems a little unnecessary and, frankly, a little stupid, and I think you're charging us by the word, and that's why you're including this. If I define maximum allowable and say the plan will only pay up to the maximum allowable, doesn't that mean anything in excess of the max allowable is not payable? And if it's not payable, why do I have to explicitly exclude it? It's almost as if I said, Brady, I will eat either one or two apples with lunch, but two apples is as much as I'll eat. And Brady says, what about the third apple? I exclude the third apple. Why do I have to go and say that? Well, you may be surprised to learn that I've actually engaged in conversations with providers where the plan has paid up to the maximum allowable. The charges exceed the max allowable, so there's a balance, and they want to balance bill the patient. But before they balance bill the patient, they want to dip their hands into the deep pockets of the plan. And they ask, okay, we see that you've paid the max allowable according to the plan, but what about the claims beyond the max allowable? Will they pay them? And they say, well, no, they're more than the maximum allowable. Well, by maximum, do you mean it's the maximum allowable? Okay, so you get what I'm saying. It's nice to be able to explicitly advise, you know what I'm going to do with those claims that exceed the max allowable? I'm going to exclude them. Here's the language. Please help me out. Let's put that language in your plan. Hazardous pursuits, hobbies, activities. Adam loves this exclusion almost as much as I love excess, and the reason is because he loves to try and come up with different examples of hazardous activities, and I think what's cool about this is it's very much based on geography or the nature of the plan, and being that we do travel all over the country and, frankly, the world visiting clients, we get to see activities and hobbies in some places that we would definitely consider to be hazardous, but, you know, we discover from our client that it's actually commonplace and wouldn't be hazardous there. Meanwhile, things that we think are very normal, like, I don't know, eating raw shellfish, is something that a lot of people don't necessarily do elsewhere and would be considered hazardous. Speaking of going places, how about foreign travel medical tourism? This is one where
that might be hazardous.
Listen, these days, yeah, I'm not leaving my house. But, you know, one of the things to keep in mind, this is one of those exclusions where I may potentially be telling you to remove it, not to make sure it's there. Reason being, a lot of people are starting to look at things like medical tourism, and I've actually seen scenarios, and I've brought it up in podcasts and webinars in the past, where a plan begins a medical tourism program. They're sending people to places like Costa Rica for hip replacements, and then based on the terms of the plan, they need to exclude those claims because they exclude all claims arising outside the United States. If you're going to have people treat outside the United States, please make sure your plan allows it.
But I think an important piece here is we think it's really important to have this option, not only for, like, treatments like Moron Medicine, like hip replacements. You know, the Cayman Islands and Med City there is a great, great facility.
Right, good example.
But also for drug infusions.
Ah, yeah.
hemophilia drugs, a lot of different options that are out there, folks, where you can have people go overseas for drug treatment, injectables, et cetera, for a fraction of the cost of what it costs here in the U.S. So, again, these are options that should be put on the table as carve-out potential, but there is good language that we have supplied that can allow a plan to do many of these things.
I feel like it used to be just A-Rod from the Yankees used to go overseas to get blood replacement. Now everybody can do it, huh?
Right.
Yeah, we can all be celebrities. So moving on, you know, when we talk about now, we've already mentioned what shouldn't be paid. How about we talk about what is payable? And frequently people ask questions like, should we cover this? Should we cover that? Please take note, and it's funny, I've got, you know, a two-year-old at home. Yes, Adam, only one child for now.
Big news out there. We'll do a podcast on that, what Ron is doing to have child number two.
I have such a big fan base, you know, and now that it's questionable as far as whether birth control is covered anymore. You got to be careful out there, folks. So when we talk about what should we cover, you know, that's a business decision versus what must we cover. And you teach from an early age, people, there's the difference between what you should do and what you could do. And you shouldn't necessarily always do it despite the fact that you can do it or vice versa. So it's easy to tell you what the law requires. It's not as easy to tell you what you should do. That's going to require consultation and discussion regarding what your goals are, how your plan is structured, your plan base, who the participants are. So, again, that's something that needs to be discussed. But once you hone in on what you're trying to accomplish, make sure the plan language reflects that. Speaking of plan language, when you talk about things like usual, customary, it used to be that people would just kind of define it using a template definition, and then they decide they figure out what it means later. You can't do that anymore. And the reason being is because plan administrators, plan sponsors, TPAs, vendors, they're all being held responsible at the fiduciary level to pay what the plan allows and only what the plan allows. And at the same time, stop loss, they're really starting to crack down on plans and ensure that they're only paying what the plan allows. So if all of these different entities are holding you responsible to only pay what the plan allows, you better make sure that that plan language accurately reflects what you intend to pay. Don't think that, my plan says I pay Medicare plus 50% and not a dollar more, but I can pay whatever I want on a case-by-case basis. It's ERISA, man. No, it doesn't work that way. If you're going to aim for some flexibility, negotiation power, things like that, make sure the language supports it, and we do have language that you could use to create that kind of flexibility. Speaking of flexibility, one thing that seems to fluctuate frequently is mental health parity compliance. It seems to me as if we're always talking about mental health parity. What does it mean? First, the definition. What is mental health versus medical? And second, you know, there are, I think, certain treatments that maybe fall between. And the nature of parity is technically it shouldn't matter because now you're supposed to be treating them the same. And yet, this continues to be an issue that's brought to our attention regarding mental health parity and ensuring that if your plan is covering mental health treatment, is it in parity with the medical? And again, this is something that needs to not only be done in practice, but be reflected in your plan. Last but not least, air ambulance. I call it highway robbery, except they're not technically on the highway. Adam, they're flying above the highway. So it's above highway robbery. You need to make sure that if you want to address air ambulance med flight claims, you need to address them specifically. Because if you don't, they're going to treat their claims the same way you would treat other medical claims, except unlike other medical claims, air ambulance, and this is interesting, they pretty much have the right to charge whatever they want. There's no controls because of laws that were written to actually protect commercial airlines and commercial pricing, and they were able to take advantage of those rules and apply it to MedFlight air ambulance. So this is something that definitely you should consider carving out and addressing.
The key thing on that ties into the importance of utilization because, again, if you don't need to take an air ambulance, then you could have just taken an Uber or you drove or taken a bus or a train or another means to get there just as quickly or, it doesn't take too much time, that's important to bring up within the terms of your plan. And I think it needs to be addressed, and I'm happy that our flagship does address
definitely.
That.
Definitely, and we did talk about medical necessity.
Ties right back into discretion.
Medical necessity is one, and discretion is the other. Speaking of discretion, by the way, if you bleed in an Uber, I believe they do fine you, so take that into consideration when deciding how to get there. I'm just saying I read the signs. So discretion, we talked already about some of the changes that we've made to discretion.
I'm not going to go into too great detail. Obviously, as a self-funded benefit plan, particularly a private self-funded ERISA plan, if you assert discretionary authority, then when a court of law is reviewing a decision you've made, they will show you deference, meaning even if they disagree with you, and even if 9 out of 10 professionals disagree with you, as long as there's one professional, there's one rational basis, there's some evidence that decision you made was not arbitrary, they're going to support it. But you need to assert discretion in the plan document, which is why you need to assert it. But the problem is, particularly from the carrier community, the feeling was that, okay, here I am insuring, underwriting a plan, and it says, hey, here's how we pay claims more often than not, but we reserve the right to pretty much do whatever we want, whenever we want, depending on the facts.
Especially if the person that works at the company is a VIP.
Bingo. So if you're the carrier, you're starting to scratch your head and say, I'm issuing a policy for a Toyota Camry, but it says on occasion you may choose to drive a Ferrari.
That's why it's really important from a plan sponsor standpoint to treat claims consistently. So if you're going to pay for a mountain unicycling because it's still, hey, let's just be honest. If I have a unicycle company and I have a road race, I might want all my employees to do mountain unicycling. That makes sense for that particular plan. Maybe for FIA's employees, it's a hazardous activity. But if you live in Utah in the mountains and you make unicycles, this should be a covered expense. However, if it's only covered for the owner's son who falls off the mountain, but not covered for the janitor's son who also fell off that same mountain, that's when you run into problems. That's when you have these cases. It's acting consistently when it's a similar fact pattern is what's the most important part of discretion.
That's the word I'd use, consistency. And, of course, the other is definable parameters. If you can define how you're coming up with these decisions and you let Stop Loss know ahead of time what parameters you're going to use, it doesn't matter how specific you get, just let them know the resources you're utilizing. And speaking of great resources to utilize, let's tap back into this resource, Jen McCormick.
All right, quickly going through this, I know we talked about dependent eligibility a little bit, but one of the things to add on to what Ron was talking about is when we're talking about eligibility criteria, we want to make sure that when it comes to claims payment that we're not being discriminatory. We also don't want to be discriminatory in the criteria and the benefits that we're allowing different potential classes of employees to have. There still are the 105H non-discrimination rules that must be reviewed, especially if there are situations where there's a common control and the employer is acquiring new companies or purchasing new companies. When you're defining the criteria, you need to make sure that the criteria is outlined specifically and it's not going to be discriminatory where you might violate the 105H testing rules. Making sure that you are complying with the employer mandate, not specifically in the document, but also in any policies that you might have, like a handbook. Making sure that you are compliant with the waiting periods and that you're not imposing a waiting period not only for a different class of employees, but you're not imposing a different waiting period for a specific benefit so that you don't have to wait 30 days to get a transplant benefit, but maybe other benefits are available right away.
Make sure your language and your plan doc ties into your employee handbook when it comes to eligibility and enrollment, because if there's a gap there, you're not going to have stop-loss coverage. It's one of the biggest things we're noticing is gaps right here when it comes to eligibility.
Right. And also another thing to know about that, too, is that it is that time of year for renewal, and one of the requirements for the employer mandate, as we know it now, is that there needs to be that annual offer of coverage. So making sure that we're offering the opportunity for people to enroll in their plans on an annual basis. And I'm going to turn it back over to Ron.
So, you know what, Ron? I think I just want to do this slide study. Is that okay? Because subrogation is what I started this.
Yeah. Let me just get. Let me just get.
Sorry, Ron. I'm jumping on this.
I don't know
how I gave you this slide.
If there's one thing I could say, Adam, before I turn it to you, it's subrogated. I hate the auto subrogation.
I am going to step into your shoes and take over this slide. That is what the definition of subrogation is.
I've been subrogated.
Right. Think about it. Our company's tagline is empowering plans. Empowering plans is subrogating.
It is.
That's what it is. We're giving them power they didn't realize they even had.
Passion for subro.
Very important. Our subrogation language, we'll get into all these details. Here's the bottom line. We're the first company in the industry, yes, in the industry, to offer you a free review of subrogation language and offer those changes. That is why we're now in the plan document business. It all started with changing 3 pages of a 110-page plan document. You do not need a signed subrogation agreement. It makes your rights lessened, not better. It's important to know. But these are all things that we obviously give all of our subrogation clients free of charge. Oh, and here's a picture of, there's a picture of Ron and I mountain unicycling. These people are absolutely crazy, by the way, just so you know. So most of you just received over the past 20 minutes a copy of our 2017 quarterly newsletter. We go over everything. It's all in your inbox. And by the way, speaking of the questions, we obviously got so many questions today relating to what Brady talked about and all the political stuff as well as some plan doc stuff. As you can see, an hour is not enough time to do it. Next month, our webinar will also be on the same exact topic, plan documents. But over the next two podcasts, we will touch base on those as well. So please, if you have questions, continue to email us those questions so we can specifically address them on the next podcast. We will say your name if you want us to and give you a shout-out, and we will share that information. Our next webinar is November 21st, right before Thanksgiving, 1 o'clock Eastern time. It's going to be a great one, again, tied to the flagship and best practices. We will be speaking to you guys at our podcast on Friday. On behalf of Brady, on behalf of Jen, Ron, and myself, thank you. We are very humbled by the fact that so many of you dial in every single month and thank us all across the country for listening in. We appreciate it. Have a great day, great weekend. See you next month.